And now another chance to hear A Giant at My Shoulder, a series in which prominent Irish people talk about the person who has most influenced them. In tonight's programme, Piper Liam O'Flynn explains why Seamus Ennis is the giant at his shoulder.
I was born into a musical family in the village of Kill. I was in the small village of Kill in County Kildare. And my mother, late mother Maisie, played the piano and played the organ in the local church. My father was the local schoolmaster, and he was a fiddle player as well. So I was listening to traditional music from day one. But it was the sound of the Uilleann pipes that really made the big impact on me. And I became aware from a very, very early age of the existence of this man, Seamus Ennis. I remember seeing, the first time I saw Seamus, can't remember exactly when it was, but being struck immediately by just the sheer impact he made, his physical impact. He always dressed in a beautiful suit, collar and tie, and this big hat, this sort of typical dress, if you like, of the gentleman piper. Of course, he wasn't just, he was not only a piper, he was a singer, storyteller, and a collector. He was a very, very important collector, and he went up and down the country collecting for Radio Éireann, the Folklore Commission, the BBC, doing absolutely fantastic work.
At times during my pushbike days, I was obliged to leave my machine at the house of friendly people and borrow their oars and thole pins to row their boat they also let me have out to Feenish Island in my searching for song and ditty and tune at that time in Connemara. My goal was the house of people named McDonough, the two-chimneyed house of Seanine Chailimean, where songs and tunes, lilts and lore abounded, as did food and tea, fortune-telling from cards and tea-leaves, and a pleasant content in welcome.
The first time I actually found myself in the man's company was in, as I remember, 1968, at the formation, the first meeting of what's now the organisation, the Peabody Uilleann, that gathering of, great gathering of Uilleann pipers. And Seamus was there, and other great musical heroes of mine, Willie Clancy, Leo Rousham. But actually, the first time when I really made contact with Seamus was in Prosperous, the little village of Prosperous in County Kildare. Myself and other musical friends used to gather there on Wednesday evening, and we got word this particular evening, or in advance of the Wednesday evening, that Seamus Ennis was going to arrive. So, and we were all ready and waiting, and I was sitting there in sort of in with the shakes, really. And Seamus arrived, and there was just a great evening's music. But what I remember most from that evening was Seamus saying to me, you know, you're coming along well, you have a lot to learn. But he said, if you're interested, I'll teach you all I know, and I'll give you any help that I can give you. And I mean, that in itself was so, just so generous and so encouraging for, you know, for a young piper. And needless to, I mean, I just followed up on that invitation and made contact with Seamus after that. And then Seamus became ill. He was in spent while in hospital, and just before he came out, he got in contact with me. He didn't have a place set up where he could stay. So I was living in a flat in Mount Street at the time, and we, myself and the other people living in the house, we set up a room for Seamus. So he moved in and, you know, began to get himself sorted out and sort of get on his way again. And we moved, shortly after that, we moved from there to Pembroke Road. I see that as an important time in Seamus's life. He died in 1982, so I actually knew him, you know, knew him well, just for 12 years. But you know, around this Pembroke Road time and afterwards, it was maybe it was the sort of last creative, important creative time in Seamus's working life. At any rate, he got the opportunity to do some recording. And this, I think he saw this as an opportunity, an important opportunity to get his career back on track. And, of course, there were the financial considerations as well. But he set about preparing his material for a two-album deal. And when he was, during the course of doing that, I got great satisfaction out of the fact that he'd come to me and he discussed the material with me and everything. I learned a lot in that process, if you like. The two albums which emerged from that were The Pure Drop and The Fox Chase. The actual recording of those albums, I mean, marks for me the most extraordinary achievement in that Seamus went in to what was then the old Trend Studios, and I was there with him, and he recorded the two albums in the one evening with, as I remember, just two retakes. We moved from Pembroke Road to a house in Terenure. My brother had decided to join us. And at that time, this was about 1972, Planxty had just come into existence. And Seamus really took a great interest in the band. He gave us lots of material, quality stuff, if you like. And of course, there were, you know, among the purists at the time, you could say, there were eyebrows, the odd eyebrow being lifted because of our approach, I suppose, the Planxty approach. But actually, Seamus didn't seem to see it that way at all. He was much more interested in the sort of possibilities that were there within the band. And he took a great interest in the other members of the band and their attitude and their approach and their interest in the music and the songs. He gave us, you know, I remember, for example, material like Johnny Cope, the great hornpipe, the song Coonla. Of course, I was away an awful lot. We were touring continuously, which, you know, in hindsight, was, I think, was a very good thing for you know, my relationship with Seamus, in that I didn't have to deal with him on the sort of domestic level. You know, it was very much our friendship based on the, you know, our interest in music. But I mean, Seamus's domestic rhythms, if you like, were very different to the norm. I mean, in fact, Seamus really didn't have a domestic life. My brother, in hindsight, again, I feel, I mean, I don't know how he coped with the situation, to be honest, because he did a day job, and he was studying for his degree at night. And Seamus led, you know, really a sort of topsy-turvy life. Seamus was a night person. He would sleep during the day, and he loved to have callers in the evening time. And he didn't want to let them go either. He loved to have them, try and keep them there all night and entertain them and so on. And, of course, in the meantime, the poor brother, Michal, was trying to grab a few hours sleep before, you know, he set off on his... the following day. Seamus just lived for the music, and... I think, like, you know, a lot of artistic people, he didn't, he took very little interest, just didn't have much time or patience for the goings-on in the world around him. Just completely taken over by the music. And, of course, it was my brother, Michal, who had to try and come to terms with this wonderful free spirit that was Seamus Ennis. Work-wise, in turn, things were going on apace in Seamus's musical life. There was a great album emerged, 40 Years of Piping, and a man named Pat Skye was instrumental in making that happen. It's just a wonderful musical document of Seamus's playing down the years, and some of the piping on that album is just absolutely superb. It just doesn't get any better. Another brilliant project that Seamus undertook in that house in Terenure was the putting together of what he regarded as the 50 finest, best slow air tunes that he knew. And he called them his 50 dark horses. And the care and the love that he lavished on the project was wonderful. He notated in that beautiful, wonderful hand of his, the music, and then underneath the music he wrote the words again in the beautiful hand and the old Irish script. One of the tunes, as I remember, that Seamus was planning for his 50 dark horses was the slow air tune Cuis Amhain na Séid by the River of Gems, one of the great Munster Aisling tunes. I play that now, or as Seamus used to say, wait till I blow up. Huge impression and impact on me. And it's interesting that there was never any formal tuition situation between the two of us. I was just absorbing the piping and what went into it, if you like. I was fascinated. It became, you know, his slow air playing, when I first heard it, I mean, I was astounded. It was just a revelation to me. I used to try and figure out what it was about it that was, for me, so extraordinary. And, of course, then we got I got to asking about the slow airs and his playing of them. And, you know, he drew me into that world and pointed out to me that, you know, how important it was that one knew something, at least, about the background. You know, knew at least one verse of the songs that went with the tunes. And I followed up on that, indeed, and got to realise just, you know, the importance of, if you like, the implications of the language for the actual playing of the tune and the style of playing it. And things like, you know, he showed me that, you know, there wasn't just one way, for example, of playing a note, that indeed, you know, there were several ways of playing the same note depending on the needs of the tune or the phrase or whatever. You know, in this context, I always think of what I regard as the sort of unmistakable Ennis tone in piping. And this was, you know, people tend to regard the Uilleann pipes as a sort of an instrument of just, you know, the sort of same tone, sort of monotone almost. And in fact, it was brought home most clearly to me and strongly when this thing about tone, when Seamus Ennis played my pipes for me once, and again, you know, here was this unmistakable Ennis tone. Life with Seamus Ennis was never dull. Apart from his passion for music, his love of music, he had this huge passion for motor cars. And he'd been talking about buying a car for some time. And he had an interest in the large Ford Zephyr car. And he got one of them. And I remember when I was at home and... No. I'd arrived and I saw this arrived home from travels, and this great black Ford Zephyr car was sitting outside the house. So I went in and Seamus was just waiting to see what my reaction would be. So I said, "God, whose car is that, Seamus?" "It's my car," he said. So we went out immediately to have a look at the car. And at the time I forget what I had, but it was a very small car compared with this one. So I remember remarking to Seamus, "God," I said, "Seamus, this is a huge car." And he was kind of, you know, a bit disgusted, a bit taken aback. And he sort of paused and he said, "Look, Liam," he said, "the way I see it is big man, big car." And he fancied that he was a very good man at tuning the engine, because he reckoned that... to be able to, if you could tune a set of pipes, then you should be a real expert in the tuning of car engines as well. But anyway, remember, I'd heard something about Seamus's, you know, kind of exploits behind the wheel. He was he's a fairly aggressive driver, to put it mildly. But Willie Clancy was ill in hospital at the time over in Galway. And we decided to make a trip to visit Willie. And of course, we went in the new Zephyr, and it was a fairly hairy drive across country, but we got there. But a kind of sad sequel in a way was that Willie really was very ill, and we were told that we just couldn't get in to see him. And I know Seamus was really anxious to see him, but in fairness, he didn't make a big thing about it. And what we did was we bought a detective novel for Willie, and I remember Seamus writing on it, "Get well soon, Willie, and don't forget the ghost C. Best regards, Seamus and Liam." I don't know what he meant by the ghost C. But anyway, we betook ourselves from the hospital and went over to into Oranmore, into McDonough's pub, and stayed there, yarning away about about Willie and about Milltown Malby and so on. One of my favourite slow air tunes is one I would associate with Willie Clancy, and a tune called Astore Machree. I played this tune on in memory of Willie Clancy, but the nice sort of tie-up is that I'm playing it on the Seamus Ennis pipes, the old coin set. I think it sounds really, really beautiful on the flat set. Drinking certainly played a destructive role in his life, in his personal life. You know, his health certainly suffered. But mind you, judging by his achievements, you'd have to honestly say it didn't affect his work. I mean, the sheer scale of what he achieved speaks for itself. Seamus was very well aware indeed of his place in traditional music and the importance he had in the tradition. And he was also aware, you know, that he was, during his life, in his work, he was, you know, pretty much on his own. He didn't, you know, during his lifetime, he didn't get any, you know, formal or, you know, official recognition. And indeed, you know, piping at the time wasn't anything like as popular and indeed fashionable as it is now. So I suppose, he didn't really get due recognition in his own lifetime. But he had a terrific belief. He had a terrific belief in himself and in his work and in his music. And this was what really sustained him. His final home was out in the Knoll in County Dublin, and he got a site. He was given a site by a farmer out there, indeed the farm which his grandfather had, and the present owner was very, very kind in giving Seamus this site, and Seamus bought a mobile home for himself and set up out there. And you know, I remember people saying at the time, gosh, isn't it absolutely awful that Seamus Ennis is living out there in his own sort of misery or whatever. But I know for a fact that Seamus was really happy out there, back in his grandfather's place. It was actually opposite the graveyard, and Seamus used to say about his father, with a little glint in his eye, himself is just across the road. Few occasions Seamus asking me to play his pipes, and that was a great thrill, terrific thrill. And then one time he mentioned to me, he said he felt he'd like to leave his pipes to me, and I said if he felt that way I'd be honoured, and I never mentioned it after that, never pursued it, and he never mentioned it. But I remember I was away travelling again, and one evening Seamus was in, he was in poor health at the time, feeling very, very low, and he got in touch with a girl who lived in the Mount Street flat, a girl named Anne Lane, and Anne worked for Mary Robinson at the time. And, of course, Mary Robinson was a solicitor. And basically, Seamus got in touch with Anne because he felt he hadn't much time and he wanted to make his will. So Anne got in touch and... but, in fact, it was actually Nick Robinson, Mary's husband, who came out. In the course of drawing up the will, Seamus said he wanted to leave his pipes to me. And Nick Robinson asked him, well, you know, why do you want to leave your pipes to Liam O'Flynn? And Seamus came up with the answer, because he can play them. I remember returning anyway from travels and people telling me about how Nick Robinson and Mary had been on The Late Late Show and how Nick told that story. And I really felt very, very touched by it. Seamus died in 1982, and the funeral was just, it was something else. It was a real society occasion. The weather threatened. There were thousands and thousands of mourners, and there was a real who's who of musicians. I've no doubt Seamus would have absolutely loved it. But we were all gathered there, paying, you know, our last respects, our last goodbyes, paying homage to this truly great man. And I remember sitting at the graveside very, very proudly and playing. When I think of the man, Seamus Ennis, and his legacy, it seems to me his piping, it's a benchmark for pipers to aspire to. I remember Brendan Brannock commenting and indeed writing that Seamus had, says he has set a headline and a challenge for the younger generations of pipers. And that is absolutely true. I find myself returning to the Ennis piping continuously. And every time I do, I leave with something new. It's extraordinary.
In that programme, you heard Liam O'Flynn pay tribute to the legendary piper Seamus Ennis. The producer is Marion Richardson, and the series producer is Lorelei Harris.